While we are still waiting for others, I would like to welcome you all to this event. As you know, the morning sessions will be held in English and the afternoon sessions in Finnish. So this is just for everybody to know. And I'm welcoming you all on behalf of Haukkala Foundation. I'm the secretary of the board of Haukkala Foundation. My name is Päivi Fadikov, and I'm also working at the university as the head of planning and development in the Agora Center. So welcome. And it is my great honor to welcome Dean Professor Maria-Leena Laakso to open officially this event. So welcome, Mari.
So, dear members of the Haukkala Foundation, distinguished guest speakers, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to welcome you all to attend this seminar titled Early Childhood Education and Care in a Turning Point. The topic of the seminar is both timely and highly important. Personally, I very much rejoice this seminar and its theme, as besides of being a dean in the Faculty of Education, I'm also a professor in early childhood education. When I first heard the theme of this seminar, I started wondering what is exactly meant here with the concept of turning point, to what kinds of changes it is referring to. I also wondered whether there might exist some shared understanding about the questions like, what are the core elements of change in early childhood education and care, or what features the turning point? Of course, this topic and those questions can and should be regarded from various levels, international, national, local, organizational. I'm very convinced and also excited about the fact that today's keynote speaker, Professor Matthias Urban, will most probably open and deal this issue from a broad and fresh international perspective. I think we are very much looking forward to hearing his wise views and expert perspective on this issue. However, as I'm impatient, so before waiting to have the chance to listen to Professor Urban and you other excellent guest speakers of today's seminar, I thought I might do a very brief inquiry and clarify a little bit to myself how people from different contexts in local level see this turning point in early childhood education and care. My short oral inquiry was made to four different respondent categories. The first person to whom I posed this question was a member of our Municipal Education Committee, a political decision maker. He saw that the main cause for changes, rethinking and reorganizing of the ECEC services are due to the financial cuttings, which concern almost each public sector in our city. According to his opinion, this situation is due to both national level political decisions of our present government and to poor financial situation of the city of Jyväskylä. The next experts I turned to with the question of the nature of the turning point were a couple of persons who are in charge of organizing the ECEC services in the municipal level. They saw that the changes in ECEC context are due to the more general changes that are taking place in our society as a whole. So because the society is changing, the early childhood education and care services have to change too. These kind of changes relate, for example, to more individual and family-driven organization of daily schedules in daycare centers. There is no longer the situation that children come and are picked up at rather similar time points. Nowadays, the children come and go according to their parents' varying work schedules and families' own individual needs. The municipal ECEC authorities also mentioned the new Act of Early Childhood Education and Care, which came into effect last year in Finland. They were especially delighted about the emphasis the new law places on children's and parents' participation. According to them, the consequences of the new legislation are already noticeable, for example, in the actions of the client panels, which are the forums of the parents. The client panels have become more active than before towards municipal ECEC officials and even towards policymakers and politicians in order to have their voices heard and families' perspectives taken into account in planning and implementing the pedagogy and practices in early childhood development and care. My third respondents came from our own university, and they were teachers and researchers in early childhood education. This group of experts also highlighted the role and meaning of the new law as an important source of driving changes and constituting the important turning point in ECEC. They were optimistic about the law's possibility to affect not only the text in the new curriculum we shall have in next month, but also the everyday pedagogy and practice. The most wanted and meaningful change that they expect to happen relates to children's participation. They believe that we will eventually witness a change where children become true partners in planning activities, putting them into practice and evaluating them. Besides these very positive prospects for forthcoming changes in ECEC, the teachers and the researchers considered the economic issues as a considerable threat. They expressed serious concerns about whether and how these important reforms can be executed under decreasing resources. High-quality education of kindergarten teachers and educators was regarded very essential, as well as successful multi-professional teamwork to fulfill each child's right for high-quality early education and care also in the future. Last but definitely not least, I turned to real experts and asked young children's opinions about the things that are important in daycare and about the things that demand reform. I was told with many different expressions about the importance of the friends. One girl said that friends are the best thing in daycare center, and definitely they are not the ones that could be changed. For some children, the positive turning point would be if there are much more room and time to exercise and to be physically active. These early experts were also claiming more possibilities to make decisions, and they wanted to spend less time in nukkari, so less sleeping during the day. So taken together, the picture of the ECEC in turning point seems to be a very multifaceted phenomenon already from the perspective of one city and several of its actors. I think that the picture becomes much more complicated when we add here the issues which are heavily discussed in international ECEC context, like individualization, schoolification, standardization, privatization, marketization. The lesson I learned from our family's 24/7 project, led by Professor Anna Rönke, who will give her presentation in the afternoon, was that the quality of ECEC services and the well-being of children in these institutions is definitely not solely dependent on the quality of the ECEC system as such, but heavily dependent on the other important institutions and, for example, the family, social and work policy decisions in our country. So with these thoughts and words, I end my opening remarks. However, I would still like to use this opportunity to most warmly thank the organizers of this seminar. I'm very happy that our faculty can be part of this important event with so topical theme. I wish you all a very rewarding and interactive seminar. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Laaksop, and I think this was an excellent opening to the seminar and also a presentation of what we all expect of our next presenter, whom I would like to welcome here now. Professor Matthias Urban is the director of Early Childhood Research Centre in University of Roehampton in the UK, and he is a well-known expert of early childhood education and care, the challenges, competencies and current trends are topics of his publications. So I'm happy to welcome you here. I'm sure we all expect to hear interesting things.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me to this fascinating and interesting and really important day that you're organizing here. Can everybody hear me? I have a green light. This any better now? Okay. Let's try again. So thank you very much for inviting me to this very important, very interesting, fascinating day. I have to apologize from the very start. It is embarrassing that my Finnish is non-existent and I have to talk to you in English. I hope we can engage in some conversations and discussions, and I'm told that the second part of the day will be in Finnish, so you can all engage in the conversations. But this is part of I think one of the major problems we are facing internationally in early childhood education and care, that a lot of the policies, the research that is seen as relevant is being written, conducted in English. And this has a lot of implications because it is not only about the language of communication, it is also about a frame of thinking, a way of making sense of the world that comes with the limitations of the English language only. And I think we need to be very aware of this. So what I would like to do today is actually take you on a broad tour through some, what I think are very critical issues internationally in our field. But before we do this, I would like to start with these two quotes. These are from a research project, very recent, a project that was interested in families' perspectives and their experiences in early childhood education and care. And these are two voices from a father and from a teacher in this project. We asked them about their experiences in early childhood with early childhood services. This is what they told us. Can we do a quick brainstorm? Any ideas, any suggestions where this might have been recorded? Any ideas? Wild guesses. Quite often when I ask this question, I get suggestions like Uganda or Bangladesh, and then somebody says, oh, it could actually be up in New York in Queens. Somebody says, well, no, this is just where I work in East London. These two quotes, the father and the teacher, have been recorded in the heart of the European Union, in Croatia, in the center of one of the most affluent regions of this world. And why is this important? We're going to come back to these two quotes. They could have chosen to talk about the curriculum, the layout of the classrooms, materials, relationships between the teachers and the practitioners and the children. They chose to talk about these experiences that shape and impact and influence early childhood experiences, the context for growing up in our societies. So let's talk about context a bit. Let's then move on to what I think see as a global pressure towards uniformity in our field. And let's try and end with some views on possible pockets of resistance against this global pressure and some old and new alliances that we can form. The two quotes in the opening slide are a reminder that the context for growing up in our societies has changed dramatically. So growing up under conditions of poverty and exclusion is a reality for an increasing number of children in Europe, and not just in Europe, in all developed countries. So the experience of being marginalized is an experience that is no longer confined to the margins of society, neither geographically nor socially. There is what some call the dictatorship of no alternatives. Tina, my old friend Tina, it's a quote from the Brazilian writer Humberto Unger, who says, there is this dictatorship of no alternatives. We're being told constantly that there's only one way of organizing policy in society. There's only one way of organizing economies. And in some countries, more than others, these austerity policies have impact on the lives of family more than in others. And there's an excellent recent publication, the 2015 Crisis Monitoring Report, who spells out in detail the implications for young children of these austerity policies across Europe. So the experience of poverty and exclusion have become a new normality across Europe, including the most affluent countries. And just to give you an example from the country where I live and work, the United Kingdom, a 2015 report called Breadline Britain by Lansley and Muck spells out that there's 1 in 5 children in the UK suffer from poverty in cold and damp homes. They suffer from malnutrition. And this is a country which is part of the G7, the most affluent, the group of most affluent economies in the world. And according to the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Report, the country within this G7 club where the wealth inequality is rising and rising and rising at an alarming rate. Context, again, if we look at the wider context in Europe, in 2015, more than 1 million refugees and migrants entered Europe through perilous routes, fleeing war, violence, persecution in countries like mostly Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. Many of them are coming to Europe to seek asylum. Despite highly questionable actions taken by the EU to prevent refugees from entering, and you're all aware of the state of the European Union trying to do its best to not let people enter, numbers are rising. And you can see here, I've produced this slide some months ago. Every time I go back to the figures, they go up and go up and go up. Just go to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, look on their website for updated figures. UNICEF estimates that one in four of the asylum seekers are children. That's a total of more than 100,000 children in the first half of 2015 alone. This is part of the context for early childhood. So the right, or making sure that there is, that we realize the right to inclusive and culturally and locally appropriate early childhood education and care and development for all children is no longer a question that's relevant to what we used to call developing countries. It is a question right here in the heart of Europe. Rosy Paidotti, the Italian a feminist writer who now works at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, talks about the boundaries between center and periphery becoming blurred. And my argument in all this is that because we can no longer make this distinction between developed and developing, the center and the periphery, the margins and the mainstream, we urgently need to learn with and from interesting, forward-looking and successful initiatives in countries like Kenya and Colombia and Palestine, because we're dealing with very similar issues at the moment. I'll come back to this. So this is what Rosie Bardotti says. I'm going to sprinkle in a bit of theory every now and then. She wrote this before what we now see as the unfolding crisis in Europe. A couple of years before, in 2010, I think this was written, or 20, I don't know. But her argument is that because the state of our societies in Europe, it is extremely important that we shift our focus and that we shift the political and professional debate and our attention to questions of diversity and of difference, not so much between cultures, us and them, but about diversity and difference within our cultures, our environments, our countries. And she talks about the importance to embrace complexity and to step away from dualistic thinking, right and wrong, me and you, us and them. This is no longer a way to look at what we're doing. So let's look at some of the policy developments around all this. What is early childhood education and care for? What are early childhood services for? When we look at it from a perspective of the European Union, early childhood has been on the EU policy agenda for quite some time. Can go back to 1992, to the Council recommendations on childcare. What's interesting about this is I'm not going to talk through any of these policy documents in great detail, because you can, this is something you could easily find and read. What's interesting about this is that the understandings of what early childhood services are, who they are for, and what purpose they serve, they have shifted dramatically since the beginning of this policy debate at EU level in the early 1990s. It all started with an idea of childcare services as a commodity, as something to serve a much broader socioeconomic agenda in order to enable, encourage women to enter the labor market. What you need is childcare. You want women to enter the labor market because you have a strategy, or the EU had a strategy at the time, to become the most competitive economic environment in the world by 2010. That didn't quite work out, but as part of this overall strategy, childcare services were seen as a key policy tool. This has changed over the years. Most of the policy documents that you find in the 2000s talk about, they no longer talk about childcare. They talk about early childhood education and care. Almost one word, hyphens in the middle. Education and care are seen as inseparable. That's taken for granted in policy documents. Education has entered the discussion. So for the first time, children actually appear in policy documents talking about early childhood. So it's no longer the service for the working parents. It is about realizing the right to education for each and every child from birth, which is, by the way, enshrined in the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. So on the one hand, we see education entering the debate. with education, we see children and children's perspectives entering the field. So it's no longer just about providing a service for families, but it's also about providing an educational environment for children. With this goes a development that from the individual child that has to be cared for, looked after, we shift our focus to an entire period of human life, early childhood, which comes into the policy focus and which all of a sudden is seen as problematic, interesting, something we need to do something about. Martin Woodhead writes about the critical period in human life. And many of us, and I suppose many of us in this room, have argued for this change. We've argued for the educational value of early childhood experiences. You said this is not just about care. You said this is not just about changing nappies. The interactions between adults and child from day one are educational. And we need to emphasize this educational value of what we're doing in early childhood services. So we have been part of this. The interesting thing and slightly worrying, well, actually more than slightly worrying development, if you look at the very recent documents that come out of the European Union, you see another shift. All of a sudden, the sea begins to disappear. Many of the more recent policy documents, they don't talk about early childhood education and care. They talk about early childhood education. What happened to care? Kathleen Lynch, who works at University College Dublin as professor at the School of Social Justice, she's written a lot about what she calls a careless society that she sees us entering in many respects. And she says the education sector has made a huge contribution across the board from early childhood to higher education to producing what she calls a careless society. So as part of, sometimes it's referred to as a lifelong learning agenda, as part of an international global shift in policies, we're seeing a move that emphasizes early education over care, over relationships. And we see this appearing not just in the European Union, but in documents that come out of the World Bank, that come out of the OECD, and many other global actors. And still, despite all these dramatic shifts from the 1990s, from child care to early child education and care, to now this new interest in education only, early childhood is still seen as a key policy tool to achieve much broader, much bigger, much more ambitious policy goals. Which brings us to one, I think, of the conclusions along this journey, that early childhood inevitably is a political field, a political practice, a political arena. We cannot pretend to just interact with children in our classroom and the world outside has nothing to do with us. But I mean, I don't need to tell you this. So many in the early childhood sector, and I include myself, have argued for a right to education in the broadest sense from birth. And we said we mean education in the broadest sense. So an interaction, a caring interaction with a newborn child, with a baby, the caring interaction of changing diapers is educational. And every educational relationship in a preschool has to be caring as well. We talk about education in the broadest sense. The big problem, and this is related to me talking in English to you, is that in the global discourse, a very narrow definition of what education means prevails. And this is firmly grounded in English language discourses. And it's also constantly reinforced by what I would say are global agents of neoliberalism, if you want, the European Union, the OECD, the World Bank, and increasingly philanthropic capitalist endeavors, including the Clinton Global Initiative and Zuckerberg's and some others. The big dilemma is that we talk about education as if it had one fixed meaning. But what about the concept of éducation in French, which has a very different connotation to the English education? What about the Spanish éducation? What about the German Bildung? What about the Portuguese and Brazilian hinting at Paulo Freire education as a practice of liberation, a political practice? So increasingly, we see in early childhood questions of difference, diversity, and increasingly inequality for children and young families are framed in terms of educational achievement gaps. We're being told that young children from marginalized groups, there's an achievement gap compared to children from dominant groups in societies. And this is constantly documented and evidenced through assessment. And we're now entering a phase where the OECD is arguing for a large-scale international outcome measurement exercise with young children. So there is this constant policy mantra that we see about closing the gap, and you will all be familiar with policy documents at national and international level that talk about we need to close the gap, and we need to do something about closing the gap, and programs are being set up and all this. My big question is, are we actually, by constantly reiterating this and by constantly sort of suggesting policy solutions that say we need to get everybody to participate in high-quality early child education and care. That's the wording of one of the EU policy documents. Are we actually contributing to keeping that gap wide open because of our very limited understanding, very limited respect for ways of learning, growing up, rearing children in the diversities of groups and cultures in our societies? And I'll come back to that. I want to give you a critical example of this sort of global policy documents. There is a document published by the World Bank. The World Bank is one of the key actors in early childhood education at the moment globally, especially in developing countries. There is an education strategy published by the World Bank, and it's on the website, so it's easy to find. The document is called Learning for All, Investing in People's Knowledge and Skills to Promote Development. The title is interesting. There are some key concepts in there that already indicate the direction. It's about learning. It is about investing, which implies that you expect some return on investment. It's about knowledge and skills. And it has a purpose, promoting development. The interesting thing is, if you flick through this document, and I did a sort of a quick and rough search, you can do this if you type Control F into your document and look up these words. The entire World Bank education strategy mentions human rights only in passing, in a half sentence. Children's rights are completely absent from this document. The concept of play doesn't appear once in this document in relation to education. Diversity is a term that is completely missing from the World Bank education strategy. Democracy, nul point, doesn't appear. But the term assessment gets 107 hits on the 112-page document. That gives you an idea of the direction of travel. I admit this is not a very thorough content analysis of this document, but it gives you a broad idea, and I would encourage you to look it up yourself. Why is this critically important? I mentioned that the World Bank is a major actor in early education in many countries. An example for the ways of operating the World Bank is that they provide funds for countries conditional to countries applying what used to be called a structural adjustment program, which is basically about ways of running government and public services, which is usually about cutting costs, about privatizing services, outsourcing services in education. The example of Tanzania in the 1980s to 90s is one where the country had a fairly good developed public education system. After World Bank intervention and World Bank funds being provided and the country being forced to structurally adjust their public education system, enrollment rate in primary school dropped to about 70% from 100% very quickly. The sector was pushed towards privatization, towards reducing the salaries of teachers, public sector cuts. This is 1980s, 1990s. You would think something could have been learned from these experiences. A recent report, and there are several data sources for this, Education International, Ben, looking into countries like Ghana, Uganda, and Malawi now, in 2016, report very similar developments. The World Bank pushing countries into opening their education systems, including early childhood education, to private for-profit providers, because that's the belief. We have to involve private for-profit public, private providers. Then there is usually one large global provider, which is a corporation called Pearson's, who's the largest for-profit education and assessment and test provider in the world, who operate under the name of Bridge Academies in Africa, offering what they call low-fee-paying private schools. The idea being, the state is not in a position to provide free and public education for all. Why that might be is never discussed. Why countries are being left in a situation where public funds are not sufficiently supported to provide education for all. The World Bank requires private involvement. Income Pearson and Bridge Academies, offering what they call low-fee-paying private schools. And they say, because nobody can afford all this, the fees are really low. We keep this, nothing compared to what you would expect to pay for private education in Europe or North America. But of course, the fees still amount to 40 to 70% of a family income, which immediately forces families in these countries, as we speak, into having to make very tough decisions about what child are they paying for, if they are able to pay at all. And quite often, they come to the decision to pay for the boy child. So we see participation rate of girls dropping in these countries. So it's not just sort of in the cloud policy strategies. It has immediate effects on the life experiences of young children. Here's another example. This is from an email, a personal communication from a friend in Bogota, Colombia. I have been working with her in several projects for some time. She shall not be named. She was invited, together with a number of colleagues, to a meeting in Bogota, hosted by the Ministry of Education and the OECD. The OECD is very interested of building connections with Colombia as one of the up-and-coming economies in Latin America, especially now with the peace deal on on the horizon and all this. And it was about discussing, this meeting was about discussing early childhood policies in for Colombia. Colombia has, over the last couple of years, developed one of the most interesting, most ambitious early childhood policy framework that I've seen so far in the world. It's called De Cero a Siempre, from zero to always, and it is one of the most integrated ideas of how to address early childhood and growing up in a country. It brings together the sectors of health, of well-being, of social cohesion, of combating poverty, of building peace, of education for young children under one framework. And it doesn't just talk about it, it also has a strategy and money to actually implement this kind of practice. The OECD representatives at this meeting, according to my friend, said, what you really need to do is come up with a curriculum that gets children ready for school. That's about early numeracy and early literacy. And you need to sign up to the early years learning outcomes assessment, and you need to make sure that in the long run your ranking in the sort of PISA league tables is improved. And they were arguing that children are wasting an awful lot of time playing in what we do in early childhood. This is the kind of discussion that we're having in 2016, promoted by organizations like the OECD in a country like Colombia. So it's all about PISA, it's all about the league tables, it's all about the comparison. Some more excerpts from my communication with my friend. What to do about this? This, by the way, is the Colombian early childhood policy framework, the Cero a Siempre, which was actually passed into legislation only very recently, some three or four weeks ago. But it has been in operation for some years now. So you can see the different sectors, salud, health. It's all coming from a very broad human development perspective, desarrollo humano. And it has things like education, social cohesion, igualdad, which is equality, as the cornerstones of all this. And what they did is politically extremely interesting. Because you might expect with all these different areas, you immediately get into sort of turf wars between different government departments. Is it who's responsible, health or education? Social welfare or whatever, whose budget is it? What they did is they took the whole package out of the responsibilities of the individual government departments. They set up an interdepartmental new body. They took money from the different departments, put it into a central budget. This new group is chaired by the President of the Republic, so it's a very high-ranking policy body, and they are in charge of implementing the strategy. And Colombia is rolling out lots and lots of what they call Centros de Desarrollo Infantil, early childhood development centers, who offer these services in local communities in very remote areas, but also in the cities. So this is what the OECD says has to stop. We need to teach them. Here's another story, a bit closer to home. This is from a project that we did some years ago in Ireland. The project was called the Family Wall Project, and we conducted it together with an organization called EDEN, which is the early childhood. It's the Equality and Diversity Early Childhood National Network in Ireland, and EDEN is a member of an organization called DSET, which I'm coordinating, which I'm chairing. DSET is an international network for diversity in early childhood education and training. So that's the background. In this project, we did something that we call the family wall, which is very basic in terms of practice. You're all familiar with this. We asked practitioners to talk to families, to ask them to bring in family photos, put them up on the wall as a way to initiate conversations about families, different types of families, and my family, your family. This is me with mom and dad. This is me with my two moms. This is me and the dog. And so family diversity, initiate conversations about family diversity. That was the idea. In one of these services, and there was a child, not this one. I have permission to show these photos, but a young child in one of the services was seen as extremely disruptive and problematic by practitioners. The child, a young boy, didn't talk, didn't engage with other children. Sometimes it was extremely disruptive. They couldn't really connect to him. And he was set on track for all sorts of diagnoses. Something must be wrong with this child. And I'm sure we can find a Latin name for it, for the condition. And so you could actually see the trajectory already being set for this child. The day the family photos came in, there was a very similar situation to this. Children went up to the wall and pointed and looked. And this young boy had a photo as well. And it was a young boy from the traveler community. Another child looked at the photo and said, "Is this a horse in your picture? Do you have a horse?" And you could not believe what happened. It was like somebody switched on the light. The eyes opened of this young boy, and he started talking and said, "We have many horses." And for the first time, he had something to relate to, something meaningful to talk about, and it turned out there was a huge expertise in this child. He knew everything about horses, the different types of horses, what they were called, how you look after them, what they eat, what they used for, because that's what his family did. We're getting there. So the question in all this is, and the practitioners, the educators, had never even realized this wealth of knowledge and this expertise and this way of being in the world of this child and the family. It was completely ignored. So my question in all this is, setting up curricula, setting up approaches, setting up practices, policies, whose knowledge and experience do we value in all this? What kind of knowledge do we see as relevant? What kind of knowledge do we see as irrelevant? And even more important, who decides? Who has a say in all this? And who is constantly silenced in these processes? I think that's a crucial question we need to ask in our everyday practices. Moving a bit further afield to Kenya, this is from my friend John Nazike, who works for Kenyatta University. And John is a member of the Turkana people, a semi-nomadic people in the northern part of Kenya. When he talks about early childhood education, he says, for our people, it's really about learning through doing. It's like an apprenticeship. This is an early childhood learning environment. And he says early childhood learning is participative. Children are doing things with other and with adults in the community. And it's also because children are making meaningful contributions to the community from a very young age. They're not separated in classrooms or whatever. It's also socially transformative. And last but not least, he says, early childhood education is learning for survival for Turkana people. I think that there's a lot to be learned from John's view and from the Turkana people, because I think looking at the state of the world, I think we all need to talk a bit more about learning for survival
in early childhood. Rosie Pardotti again urges us to think theoretically about the urgency of finding new and alternative models of political and ethical agency to counter the self-interest, what she calls of neoconservative thought. So there are some theories that we need to engage in which are not necessarily traditional ways of thinking in early childhood. But we also need to think about different ways of, well, being in the world, looking at the world. And this is from Jenny Ritchie, a colleague of mine in New Zealand, who works in a Maori community. She says that there is this real issue that Western approaches, what she calls Western approaches, to learning and to assessment, have failed to take into account the spiritual, social, cultural, emotional well-being of children and communities. And she suggests that we need to re-engage with this interconnectedness. And she says this is a form of resistance against what I've been trying to outline, these kind of global policies that push us into one direction of assessment, of testing and measuring. And the recognition of spiritual dimensions and about the connectedness between the individual, the community, the planet, is something that is becoming extremely important and that we need to learn from indigenous scholars, not just in New Zealand, but in many other countries of the world. Because, and that's quite interesting, most indigenous ways of looking at the world, understandings, and understanding knowledge, they never had this European Western dualism between nature and culture, between man, human, and world. We're now beginning on a theoretical level in sort of Western context to talk about sort of post-humanist theories. Karen Barat writes about it, building on the theories of Gilles Deleuze in France and others, saying that there is more to us being in the world than just the human. There is a connection to the material, to the world. But indigenous cultures have been saying this for centuries. And I want to sort of bring this all back to this room and to early childhood practice. Most interestingly, at the very roots of our practice is a very similar understanding. And I have to mention this, even though I'm running out of time, but I have to say this, working for the University of Roehampton, which is the original Froebel College, going back to the work of Friedrich Froebel, who started the kindergarten movement in Germany in the 1830s. And one of the women who worked with him then came to London to set up the Froebel Institute in 1872. Friedrich Froebel, that's what he writes. In the 1820s, at the very roots of our practice, about what a child is, how you understand the child. A child, Friedrich Froebel writes, attributes the same life to all about him, the pebble, the chip of wood, the plant, the flower, the animal, and each and all can hear and feel and speak. This is, I think, holistic thinking, the child, the individual, the community, the world, the spiritual, very similar to what indigenous scholars are saying in many other parts of the world. Can we establish this connection? Can we reclaim the roots of our practice as a holistic understanding of what growing up in the world and being in the world might be? Again, Friedrich Froebel about the connection between the child's inner life, the relation to parents and family, the relation to the common, and what he calls the higher invisible being, and nature. which has a life in its own. So being in a connected state, which is very different to understanding of developing a curriculum which is about teaching children to read and write from an early age, which doesn't mean they shouldn't be reading and writing. They're curious and keen, and they can do all this. To end, I would like to remind us, and this is about pockets of resistance and possible alliances as well, that Friedrich Froebel's pedagogy and philosophy was not just about spirituality and connectedness and the wholeness of the child and the world, but it was also political. It was all about pedagogical principles, the uniqueness of each child's capacity development, holistic views of child's development, the importance of play as a central element, increasingly important looking at the policy developments that we see around us, that we defend the right and the importance of play for children, but also an ecological view of humankind in the world and the child as part of family and community. But all this was developed in a political and social context which was very, very specific. It was following the aftermath of the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars. There was a democracy movement happening in Germany at the time. The Hamburg Festival, people demanding civil rights and civil liberty, press freedom, a revolutionary movement against the emperor and the Austria and Russia, trying to establish a democratic republic, right, and things like sort of democratic rights for all. And early education was part of this context from the very beginning. In 1849, the revolutionary parliament in the Frankfurt Paulskirche, where delegates from all over the German-speaking parts of Europe came together to sort of celebrate the revolution and set up the republic, they debated an entitlement, a right to kindergarten, to early child education for every child, saying that if you want to democratize society, you have to provide education for all from an early age. This is part of our tradition. This is where kindergarten comes from. And Friedrich Froebel deliberately said, all this requires highly qualified, highly trained professional educators. You can't just do this out of the love of children. This is a professional task. You need to be qualified. You need to study. And so his first kindergartens were also education institutions for women. And this was a highly radical idea in the 1840s. Professionalize women to work as educators and teachers for young children. And he also had these ideas of education being a public good, public responsibility, something that can be done and thought outside of the church and the state, but it's a public democratic responsibility. And all this was, of course, extremely radical at the time, and I must say it still is today. And so it's no wonder, no surprise, that in 1852, when this revolution basically collapsed and the Prussian state took over, one of the things they did in 1852 is they banned Froebel's kindergarten in Germany. They did not ban working with young children. They specifically banned Froebel's kindergarten for being atheist, socialist, outright dangerous. Early childhood education is political, is dangerous, and is extremely important for us to reclaim that side of the discussion as well. It is political, and I'm coming to the very end now. It is political in a way because other actors in this field claim it as political as well. I did not make this up. You can look this up. This is a real website, missionreadiness.org, US American website, and all these gentlemen are extremely concerned about the implications and the importance of early child education. They say, it's not about children, it's a matter of national security. If we don't get this right, 20 years down the line, they won't be able to serve in our forces. So even if we decide that we don't want anything to do with this, that we're not political. These gentlemen are working behind the scenes to make it political. So we need to be aware of what's going on around us. So where does this all lead us to? I think it's extremely important to always step back, look at the bigger picture, take an extended systemic approach across all dimensions of what I would call a competence system, children in context, practices, research, theory, and policy together in one picture. We need to look at the margins within, referring back to Rosie Pardotti, learning from and with indigenous methodologies for research and for practices with marginalized communities that are increasingly part of our societies. And we need to constantly ask why questions, not how questions first. Why questions? Why are things the way they are? Who benefits? Who is silenced? And questions of social justice and resistance to what some call the normality of science in our field. This is important, not because early child education and the research we're doing around this in itself is going to change the world. But as Paulo Freire reminds us in his Pedagogy of the Oppressed, all this is a step into creating understandings that enable us and others to actually engage in a professional and political and academic and an activist struggle to actually do something about the conditions that we find around us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this very stimulating and in some parts also striking presentation. And now we have, surely people have a lot to discuss, but we have the privilege of some early invited speakers to speak first. But since this was so stimulating, I would like to allow a couple of minutes for you to discuss between the neighbor, just between yourselves. And while I'm organizing this thing, please share your ideas and now with your neighboring friends in there, because it was really stimulating. I think you could continue a long time, but still we are now back to program, and our next speaker is the Ombudsman for Children, Tuomas Kurttila, and he was really sorry that he could not come here in person. He was required to join the Minister of Justice to another important occasion today. But luckily, he got to know that early enough so that he was in contact with our keynote, Professor Urban, and they discussed between themselves. And Tuomas has prepared his presentation in a video, which we will see now, and I'm sure he was also very stimulated by your thoughts.
Hyvät ystävät, dear friends, it's my honor and privilege to be able to say you some words about the topic of today. I really want to thank you for organizing this seminar. We really know that early childhood education and care is really the topic of today and for the future of our children. In today's Finland, what I tend to see are the differences between many municipalities. Also, we tend to feel and see what are the gaps between our children's achievements when basic education is over. We know that our 15-year-old boys, 1 out of 8, cannot read properly. They cannot read that they could continue their studies after the basic education. So we see tremendous achievement gaps. My office's title for our work to evaluate children's rights in Finland and really think how the children are doing in today's world and Finland is: that is Finland society for all, or is it only for a few. Early childhood education and care has been discussed and debated on quite much in several years in Finland. We know that the present government has given new legislation and really to title A Country for All or A Country for Few has been there. If we want to make something tremendous with achievement gaps, if we want that all the children have capacity and a right for learning and to be as they can be skillful citizens when they are adults, we really know that we should invest in children and in early childhood education and care. My first question for all of us today is that are we investing in children? Are we investing in a way that we really can see in our child impact assessment? In child impact assessment, we really take seriously our Convention on the Rights of the Child. Then we make those decisions that have to be there to fulfill all those needs that our children have and also those needs that society and parents have. I'm not seeing that kind of investment in childhood as we think early childhood education and care. I see huge differences between municipalities. The legislation that we have today doesn't make these gaps smaller. We know that we have several municipalities today in Finland which really offer high quality childhood education and care. They have decided, their decision makers have decided to give all the children access to good, high quality early childhood education and care. It is a right for a child. It is not something that society decides upon you or parents decide. It is something that we offer to all the children. Well, our legislation says that children are not in that kind of a equality that all the children would have access to education, early childhood education and care. We know that those children whose parents are at home, for reason or the other, those children have less. That is something crucial for us to ask, are we investing also these children? When legislation says that children do not have that kind of opportunities to attend early childhood education and care when their parents are at home, it really is something not wise, not strong, and nothing that really builds that kind of a capacity for all the children. Those children who really need early childhood education and care do not get it as much as those children whose parents are at work. That is a tremendous question for all of us. Is this for all or is this for few? When we think about our basic education, it is absolutely sure that we all think that all the children have to have same kind of access to basic education. But we are not thinking the same when we talk about early childhood education and care. Those five-year-olds, they do not have same rights in today's Finland in respect to early childhood education and care. To invest children, to really see that we are making that kind of a capacity building is one issue. Another is that always in early childhood education and care, we are supporting parents. We are supporting parental care. And we do consider that parents really take that strong responsibility of their children. But are they left alone? Are those families left alone and those parents left alone whose children do not have only that 20 hours per week or something? Are those parents left alone if we say as a society and from the legislation that you can of course apply some more hours for your children if he or she is in need? That is something where we tend to see that those parents and homes are left alone who really would need support in many ways. What I feel as an ombudsperson for children in Finland is that we are not building that kind of a society where all the children have same access to high quality childhood, early childhood education and care. That is something that we haven't thought in a way that we are really building this society with these children before the school age. We see the differences. We see the dropouts. We do tremendous issues and processes and projects with dropouts, for example, when they are 20 years old or 16 years old. But we do not care that work should be done before the school age. How we hear and listen our children. Convention says in its Article 12 that all children must be heard. When I think our children in early childhood education and care, it is still something that we have to do better. Well, we see in our school surveys, in our national school surveys, at the basic education also, that children must be heard much more deeper, in much more deeper way. The same is there with our children in early childhood education and care. Well, listening to children, hearing their voices, is something that we adults, professionals and parents need. To be able to fulfill that kind of a needs, everyday needs that children have, is something to do with hearing and listening their voices. What I urge you to do in our early childhood education and care is to listen our children. If we want to tackle the hard issue of school bullying, we have to start in our early childhood education and care. Our professionals also need a lot of support. Thinking our parents and parental care, it is something not to just left or leave to our kindergarten professionals. It is something that we need all the professionals there, from also social work and from the health services. That professional, multi-professional work has to be done, for example, in our kindergartens. Kindergarten is a place where all this multi-professional work can be done, and where parents can have their support, where we can meet them every morning, every afternoon, almost every day per week. In today's Finland, it is a hard question what kind of a differences we have between municipalities. What kind of a difference it makes in today's world and today's children in which family you are born. That is something that we have to tackle. That is the reason why legislation for early childhood education and care must be strong. I want to thank from deep in my heart our National Board of Education, which is doing tremendous work with our national core curriculum for early childhood education and care for the first time as a legislation in Finland. That is something we need. That is something we need to be able to fulfill that need for quality early childhood education and care. That is something which isn't there. It has been for the schools, for the basic education, for example, but we haven't considered early childhood education and care that important. So how to build society? How to really be able to fulfill those needs that parents have? How to combine work and family life? How to listen to children's voices? How to tackle with those issues of dropouts, school bullying, and all the other issues that children might have in their life when they grow up. That is something that we can tackle and do quite early. All the research we have today's world, and more deeper understanding about childhood, really give us opportunity to develop early childhood education and care. But when we are developing it, we need those voices that children have for us as adults. Also, our professionals, they need a lot of support, really, to be able to fulfill the article number 12 from our convention. That is the reason why the legislation has to be there. It has to offer for all the citizens, children, possibility to attend and have access to our kindergartens, for example. And as you remember, 1 out of 8 15-year-old boys cannot read in today's Finland. With all those great PISA results we have had, it is something not to do with only basic education, but beforehand. So, my friends there in Jyväskylä this morning, I hope you have a great seminar. I hope you have a great debate. I hope that you will listen what is important and you try to remember how to fulfill those needs that children and, of course, all the society have towards future, towards strong society, which is not only for few, but which is for all.
I think we can continue directly to our next comment speaker, Professor Marit Alasuutari from this Ruusupuisto building and Faculty of Education. Welcome.
Can you hear me now? Okay. First, thank you, Professor Urban, very much for your inspiring talk. And good morning, dear audience and the organizers. In my commentary, I will mainly discuss some macro-level issues in early childhood education in our domestic context. I will actually reflect on what Professor Urban said, but also discuss some issues presented by Professor Laakso in her talk. This was an accident; we didn't plan this. But so Professor Urban pointed out the transformation of the underlying understanding of what early childhood education or these services for young children are, who they are for, and what purpose they serve. He talked about the change of terminology, how we now nowadays, or the when we look at the policy documents, they don't talk about childcare, they talk about early childhood education and care or early childhood education. And he also said that this is not just a change of terminology, there's also a more profounding change in the understanding what is the purpose of the services. So if it earlier on was the services were mainly for providing care commodities for families, nowadays the focus is on education, and education as an issue that has a very, very big political importance in the present day EU. And actually, when we think about recent developments in Finland, we can recognize this change. The change of terminology by us happened officially last year when the Act on Early Childhood Education was enforced. It started earlier, but now it's in our official political documents. Professor Ullmann said that this focus on education kind of has led, and this is something he also talks about in his article, has led to a very narrow understanding about education, considering early childhood education mainly as a preschool institution, concentrating on school readiness. So we got a new act, we got a new term. Can we recognize this change in the purpose also in Finland? At the present, Finnish scholars and practitioners have contradictory views about what actually was changed by the present act. Some talk about a new act. I heard it in Manas or Professor Laakso's talk this morning. Some criticize the act for actually being still the same old daycare act that dates back to 1973. It only has a new name. Sami Mahkonen, a scholar in family law, says in his recent book that to talk about an old or a new act does not quite make sense, since when the present act was enforced, there was no old law. The Daycare Act had been renewed during the decades in such a way that none of the original statutes or regulations were in force anymore. Thus, we could say that the contemporary act is an updated version of the Daycare Act. But actually, when we look at the regulations that were changed and renewed in it, I think it resonates with what Professor Ullmann discussed in his talk. There are issues that reflect this school orientation in the contemporary act. For example, the definition of early childhood education in the act emphasizes pedagogy as an essential aspect of early education. Moreover, the act states that the goal of early childhood education is to support the child's readiness to learn and to enhance lifelong learning and educational equality. It also requires that each child has to be provided with an individual education plan. The Daycare Act did not include such issues, although in many ways the present goals are still the same as in the Daycare Act. But if we consider, for example, or study the text of the new curriculum for early childhood education that will be published in October, so we have had it here to read and to comment on, I would say that there is not a major change to kind of schoolified early education in our country. And also, if we think about the present law, on the whole, it also has other ideas and other kind of thinking in it. But this in our debates about the law, this pedagogy and kind of this school orientation has been almost the ideas that we could call school orientation have been very topical. And I would say that the recent debates have missed in many ways the systemic viewpoint of early childhood education that Professor Ullmann had or talked about in his presentation. And one of the essential aspects of our early childhood education is its intertwinement with working life. I don't know if this is possible to say say in English this way, but I would say that our early childhood education breathes at the same pace as the working life. Our services are about daycare, and they experience all the fluctuations and changes of working life through children's families, and they need to adjust to these changes. For example, one of the recent changes is, for example, the increased need for care in non-standard hours. Another are the rapid fluctuations in the need of services caused, for example, by layoffs, precarious work, as well as people moving to new areas to get work. And I would say that the present government may have increased these fluctuations experienced by early childhood institutions by restricting the unconditional right for early childhood education of those children whose parent is unemployed, and to which restriction also Tuomas Kurttila referred to. The changing needs for services create, among others, demands and challenges for pedagogy in early childhood institutions. We cannot assume that all children attend the services daily between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. We cannot assume that this is, or the mornings are, the only time when education is provided or when we can educate children. We have to think anew about pedagogy. Have to kind of seize the moment in the pedagogical work. And Professor Urban talked about or referred to post-human thinking. This is something that have interested us also in our discipline. We had a lecture series about post-human thinking last winter. And this is very new to us, but I think that's something that we are going to develop. But so in a way, if we go back to the debates about the new law and really, for example, the topic that, or suggestion that we should differentiate early childhood education and care. I would say that this suggestion forgets this, the system and the more holistic view of the field of early childhood education. The increasing fluctuation in need for early childhood education services has also system-level consequences, especially in bigger cities and towns. Many cities and towns in our country consider support to the use of private early childhood education as a dynamic means to adjust to the fluctuations in service needs and as a means to control the costs of the services. From international context, we know that private early childhood education can be linked with stratification of clientele. It can create inequalities. This is something Professor Ullman also pointed out. We do not yet know what will follow from the increase of private early childhood education institutions in our country, but we cannot dismiss the possibility that the contemporary trend will increase in inequalities between children and families. Also by us. Professor Urban said several times that early childhood education is always political. It's about policies. And for example, this municipality's interest in supporting private early childhood education reminds us of this fact and of the fact that early education, as well as its regulation, be it at the national level or at a local level, have been and still are developed and changed in the frame of economics. In the becoming years, Finnish society will experience a major reorganization in social welfare and health. After this reorganization, the municipality's responsibilities will mainly be in infrastructure and education, especially. This means for compulsory education and early education. At the moment, we do not know what will be the economic situation of the municipalities after the change and in the near near future. But it is possible that we have to also continue talking about the turning points to early childhood education services at that period. Hopefully it will be a change for better, but that's something we will consider later.
Thank you, Professor Alasuutari. And I think we will next go directly to our next commentary speaker, Professor Lea Pulkkinen, who is well known not only in this city and university but throughout Finland about her activities with children and youth and later life stages as well. So welcome, Lea.
Educators to abandon the fundamental values of their profession and adopt narrow and rigid school readiness curricula and assessment procedures. I'm speaking on the global level now, more or less it is stretching also to Finland, but on the global level. And also there are pressures experienced by policymakers who are facing pressures to bring their country's policies in line with the requirements of an increasing uniform global approach to early childhood. Whereas tables, result tables, let's say by OECD, which is an economic organization, seem to matter more than the well-being of every child. And from the Finnish point of view, I would like to add one pressure more, and it is a pressure experienced by parents, particularly women, whose work career, their income and pensions are said to be threatened if they take care of their own children. So childcare was a commodity which freed parents of women for labor market. And now we talk about a change towards early childhood education. So there are various functions at the same time. And it depends on who is speaking, the person may highlight very different viewpoints. This is the situation now in Finland, and I'll make some comments on these pressures, mainly from the point of view of a child, but in relation to the family and policy making. How to... Will you come in? Sorry, sir. So there were those, I didn't notice that this wasn't on. Okay. There were those pressures listed. And the next one, please. There are many ways to define or many sources for the image of the child. And I just listed some of them. There's scientific, there are scientific viewpoints which highlight genes and inherited resources. There are religious views. We know very little about them. Let's say Muslim views of children, although we are now living more with different religious groups, their philosophical views rather so the child learns everything. There is nothing inborn in a child. There are psychiatric and psychological views. It's a Freud's view. The child is a miniature adult who has the same sexual needs as adults. There's behaviorism, developmental psychological use. There are clinical use, and important source of the image of the child is also the Convention of the Child's Rights, which highlights the protection, provision, and participation of children. And there is the economics use, and this is the OECD growth ideology, which is now dominating very much. And the image of the child that we hold is a decisive importance for the well-being of the children in our society. And if we think that the child is a future combatant in the global competition of the country, then the society will design the services for its children in accordance with this perception. And if we think of the educational, individual educational plans that our present new law now requires that will be prepared for each child, and they are professional people who prepare these plans, what is the view of this person who prepares these plans? What is the role of the parents in this process? So how clear is the view of the child when we make plans for children for the future? This is what I want to make some comments on. There is now a prophet called Nobel laureate, professor of economics, James Heckman, who is in various contexts referred to. And please, next one. He writes that the highest rate of return in early childhood development comes from investing as early as possible, from birth through age 5, in disadvantaged families. The best investment is in quality early childhood development from birth to 5 for disadvantaged children and their families. Our economic future depends on providing the tools for upward mobility and building a highly educated, skilled workforce. Early childhood education is the most efficient way to accomplish these goals. This study that he refers to was made in very, very poor conditions. So among those disadvantaged children, he could, or people could show that that the investments were very profitable. But now in Finland, the first part of this sentence is taken, and thought that that it applies to everybody, every child. Every child who goes to the daycare then will bring back the investment 7 times. This is the way how politically can be handled some arguments. Next one, please. And his equation is that invest in educational and developmental resources for disadvantaged families to provide equal access to successful early human development. And nurture early development of cognitive and social skills in children from birth to age 5. And sustain early development with effective education through to adulthood. And gain a more capable, productive, and valuable workforce that pays dividends to America for generations to come. So do we apply these principles in Finland when we prepare these educational plans? Or what is the image of the professionals? Next one, please. An alternative view of the child is that the child is endowed with his or her inner potential to grow, learn, and communicate, and to participate in his or her own way and with his or her own rights in our human society. An agent of his or her own life, but in relation with others. The child is not an object that must be pushed and modeled into a shape that pleases the adult. Adults who are sensitive to the child's needs help him or her to unfold his or her uniqueness. The quality of relationships with important adults, such as parents and teachers, and other children are important to his or her growth as a human being. This is the kind of view a child adopted within the Alliance for Childhood European Network Group. The Haukala Foundation is a member of this network group, and it really highlights the child, the properties of the child, and trusts that if there is a good quality environment, then the uniqueness of children develop, unfold, and these people are then ready to assume responsibility for the development of the life or the society. So we don't know how the development goes. We cannot anticipate it, but these children grow and they are ready to assume the responsibility. Next one, please. Our sources for this your child can be found in a book series Alliance for Childhood EU, and there are publications and there are Michael Matthews' article, there is my article, and we discuss this image of the child. Next one, please. And next one, yes, you can put it on. Yeah. Okay. The child is, you can add the whole thing. The child is part of so many different contexts and organizations. There's a home environment, the daycare and school environment, there's work environment, the child's own and also the parents' work environment, free time environment, virtual environment, and we can add other ones also. And in each box, there are persons and organizations active that strive to attain their own objectives for that box. Often these organizations don't know each other, have different perceptions of the child, different objectives and work programs that may clash with each other. There is not one organization that overlooks the entire system. So there are compartments, and the child is split into so many different achievements. Next one, please. I was very, very pleased when I read perusopetuksen opetussuunnitelman perusteet. So I explained to Matthias Urban that in Finland the national core curriculum was just revised, and we can find the image of the child. Comprehensive basic education is founded on the inherent value of childhood. Every child is unique and valuable as he or she is. Every child has a right to evolve to his or her full measure as a human being and member of society. In this process, the child needs encouragement and individualized support and an experience that he or she is listened to at school, that his or her opinions are valued, and that his or her learning and well-being are important. What is important is the experience that he or she can build together with other people the positive functioning and well-being of his or her community. This could be an interpretive image of the child in our society more broadly, not just in school, but early education in other spheres of life also, where children and families' conditions are handled. Okay, next one, please. We have a very good law in Finland from 1983, and this is just translation of the law, but because it is so good, I would like to read it. The purpose of the child custody is to ensure the welfare and balanced development of a child in accordance with the child's individual needs and wishes. The purpose is also to secure a close and affectionate relationship, in particular between the child and his or her parents. A child must be ensured good care and upbringing, as well as supervision and protection appropriate for his or her age and stage of development. A child should be brought up in a secure and stimulating environment and receive an education that corresponds with his or her inclinations and wishes. A child must be brought up with understanding, security, and affection. A child must not be subdued, corporally punished, or treated offensively in any other way. The growth of a child towards independence, responsibility, and adulthood must be supported and encouraged. For 32 years, we have had this kind of legislation, and it is very good. And together with national core curriculum, we have a very good basis for understand what the education or, and care should be like. Next one, please. There's a convention on the rights of the child. I don't make a comment. You can find these aspects of the child in the convention. But what it is that it highlights the role of the family and the growth in the family environment. And what I'm afraid at present is that the role of the parents is neglected. In the present law, the professionalism is so strongly highlighted, and I hope that in other regulations, the role of the family could be better considered. Next one, please. And here I just make some comments on my worries that the early education by law is nowadays highlighting the pedagogics, which may exclude the parents. In previous times, daycare was provision for families, so supported homes in their task of rearing children. And some comments on policy making in respect to the child, because now the parents' pensions and their income and their career lines are highlighted very much when daycare topics is discussed, and how to share the time when the parents have the right or possibility to be with their children. And I'm just thinking, why don't these ways of covering parental costs could be arranged in a different way, so that it's not a matter of the mother's or father's employer, but it's a matter of the whole society. So if the child, the image of the child is clear in the society, then we can also arrange the work life, or we can demand changes in the work life. But as long as we have no clear understanding what the child is, then we cannot even participate in this these arguments. Thank you very much for you.
Thank you, Professor Pulkkinen. And now the floor is open for comments of the audience. Any comments? One issue that came to my mind was that as Professor Urban referred to the language issues and how we conceptualize things, I think in Finnish we have two separate words for kasvatus and koulutus, for education, and the one that is used for the early childhood education, it's more, it's broader and combines also the care aspects, I think, of the environment, the education, if it's translated as koulutus, would mean like more about the school educational things. And I think, I don't know if Marilena, would you like to say something as the dean of the department of faculty of education? What do you think about this name? I think we have discussed in many different groups about that earlier, at the terminology.
I just agree with you, and when listening to Professor Urban's excellent talk, I was thinking about the terminology, and that our word kasvatus is much more broader than the word education. And yeah, I totally agree with Päivi.
Yeah. Any other comments? So, there are no more comments in this public, I think we can continue in the afternoon and throughout lunchtime. And I would like to remind you all that this seminar is part of this Researchers' Night. And there will be a lot of children coming also here to different activities in this building today, and there will be many things ongoing, so please keep your eyes open and see what's happening, and the night will continue to tonight. And our next session will be starting at 1 p.m. in Finnish, and I think the discussion might be easier for the Finns in Finnish, so welcome back then.